Okay. Well, today's talk is on happiness and meditation.
I don't know anything about happiness and meditation. I am a hopeless meditator, I confess. Ajahn Brahm cannot meditate. I have to get out of the way first, and then meditation happens. So this is a wonderful key about meditation, learning how to let go. First story, how heavy is this orange juice? This particular simile, if you haven't heard it before, you may go on the website of the Australian Stock Exchange, where they've given this simile to make sure all the traders and brokers don't get stressed out and hang themselves and jump off the balconies of the high-rise in Sydney. I taught this in the World Computer Conference in Brisbane a couple of years ago. From there it went to the Australian National Newspaper and they put it on the Australian Stock Exchange website because it works. How heavy is this glass of orange juice? The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. After 1 minute, my arm starts to hurt. After 3 minutes, I'm in pain. If I keep holding it like this for 10 minutes, I'm in agony and a very, very stupid monk. So what should I do when it starts to get too heavy to carry comfortably? Put it down. Only for maybe 30 seconds. If you don't believe me, you can try this at home. After 30 seconds, I pick up the orange juice again. It does feel lighter. And now I can carry it without any pain for another 5 minutes. This is stress and meditation. Stress in our modern world has nothing to do with how much you have to work. I just come back from Malaysia, I make 18-hour days, 20-hour days. You guys have holidays. You know, on May the 1st, whenever there's a holiday, that's when I have to work even more. They give me more work to do because they got nothing to do, they come and bother me. But, yeah, here we go. So, I cope. Do I look stressed out? I'm not stressed out, I have a nice time. The reason is because when I do get tired, when I can't bear my responsibilities comfortably, when I lose the smile on my face, I put things down. Rest just for 2 or 3 minutes, longer the better, and then you'd get your duties again and you've got power and energy, you've rested. The ability to rest, to let things go, is what meditation is. And that's why meditation is the method for letting go of stress in life. The most fastest, efficient method. And if you just meditate for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 15 minutes spent in meditation is not wasted time. You make that up afterwards by getting more work done in less time, because you are efficient. You're using your brain efficiently. Not only do you get, say, 3 hours work done in 2 hours, but the work is high quality as well. That's why meditation is the way to have an efficient brain, so you can do more work in the office with less stress, be more productive, get all those promotions so you can give more donations to the Buddhist Fellowship.
Ajahn Brahm, is there any evidence that meditation really helps?
Yes, and you're looking at it.
Oh, yeah. Scientific evidence.
Yeah, of course. You just need to go on the internet. You just need to go on the internet, googling meditation. There's been so many studies done. Studies which, you know, scientific studies which show you that it does increase your immune system, you do get less sick. My friends who have monasteries in California, they told me that every person who lives in California has to buy their own health insurance. And on the health insurance forms, you can tick a box that you're a meditator. Get somebody like a monk to sort of sign a form that yes, you regularly meditate, and you get a substantial reduction in your health premium you have to pay. Because the evidence is very convincing, people who meditate don't get so sick. Which is one of the other reasons why the Ministry of Health in Singapore should be subsidizing this talk. We are saving Singapore Health Service huge amounts of money by teaching you how to meditate, let go of your stress, live healthier, longer without any problems. We may also, this talk should be sponsored by the Ministry of Economic Development, because by teaching you how to meditate, you're going to become much more productive as well. Make more money for this country. I shouldn't be telling you this because the Australian government will get upset at me for lessening the competitiveness of Australia. But it actually works. It also, that there was a lady over in, I think it was in Harvard, forget her name now, but she was following meditators for 7 years. She gave them CT scans of their brain. You know, from when they started, 7 years later, she actually noticed. The evidence was convincing, not just one people, but many people, comparing it with a group who didn't meditate, the control group. Your brain gets bigger. She noticed a significant increase in the size of your cortex. Literally, you get more megabytes, gigabytes between your ears. So that's science, it's there. And there's so many other pieces of research. It was Wellington Public School in UK a couple of years ago introduced meditation as a compulsory subject once a week for every child in that public high school in UK. In the interview in the newspaper, which I read with the headmaster, they asked him, first of all, are you trying to make people Buddhists? Are you some evangelist? He said, no, I'm not a Buddhist at all. I'm a Christian. But he said, the evidence is there. I've read it. It's very sound science. If you meditate, you get much higher academic performance. I'm only doing this because my job depends on the academic performance of the students in this school. I want to increase that performance. That's why I teach them meditation as a compulsory subject once a week. Not religious, but just practical, increasing your academic ability. That is also well proven. And it has so many other health benefits, social benefits, and academic benefits. It's one of these things which is like the old snake oil, but this time it actually works. The science is there, which is one of the reasons why in many places they don't call it meditation. They've gave it a scientific name, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, because meditation doesn't sound all that scientific. But mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, the MBCT, now that sounds scientific. And it works, well proven.
Just a couple of weeks ago, there was a meeting hosted by HPB, the Health Promotion Board, and we actually discussed bringing in not just Brahm Center, but other groups as well. We're talking about Mindfulness Day, having mindfulness workshops. So indeed, HPB is getting more enlightened in this space. So as you were saying.
Yeah, but there's something I would like to warn you, because who are the experts on meditation? So please go to the experts, which, please excuse me, it's the monks and the nuns.
Those who meditate, though.
Those
not
who meditate,
all of them
yeah.
Meditate.
Indeed. Because there was a professor from Stanford, I did a presentation with him in Sydney at a meditation conference a couple of years ago. It's Philippe something, I always remember it was Philippe. He was a professor of psychology at Stanford University. He did this amazing experiment. He took a group of psychology students, gave them credits to participate in this experiment. He split the group into two. One group he sent to a meditation retreat for one day, a mindfulness training retreat, and the other group he sent to a spa, a California spa, where you go in a sauna, you get massaged, you get hot oil poured all over your back. He wanted to find out who became more relaxed. So after going to the spa at the university's expense, now, Stanford is just rolling in funds, so the university paid for you to go to a spa for the day. And at the end of the day, he gave them a standard test to find out who was more relaxed. And the results were just so convincing. The people who went to the spa were far more relaxed than the people who spent the day meditating. And I say that because it's a warning to you. It's true, it's not just monks, but lay people, psychologists, who know what meditation is. It's not just being mindful. It's being kind. And unfortunately, many meditation techniques, they're mindful, but they miss out the most important ingredient of compassion. This beautiful softness and awareness which relaxes you and brings you peace. Now, I'm recognized as an expert in meditation. Even people who don't like me know, yes, your meditation teachings are really on the spot. Because that's what I do for a living. And also, you know how to teach people how to relax, to be mindful and to be kind. That is the key. So any of you who do any of these courses in meditation, make sure it's not just being aware, but it's being kind to what you're aware of. Without that kindness, you will not get relaxed and you will not know what meditation is.
That's absolutely true. I think it's also to deal with the silence, because when we go for your meditation retreat, and I've just come back from a 10-day meditation retreat, staying silent for 10 days was very therapeutic. It might be scary to some people who couldn't even stay quiet for 10 minutes, but it really does transform your life. And I think Ajahn Brahm was very surprised. I didn't even want to talk to him.
Yeah, but that was because we used masking tape. We put a little hole in there so she could have a straw. No, we didn't. You were very good. But it does actually work. And if it's mindfulness together with kindness, it does create happiness. There's something about relaxation of the body. When you're really relaxed, maybe you have been to a spa, you've been in a sauna, you've had a hot bath, or maybe you've been on holiday, and you're just laying down there by the beach, you know, with your mobile phone thrown in the ocean, nothing to worry about, nothing to do, perfectly relaxed. How does that feel? That is a form of happiness which sometimes you crave for. This beautiful body, totally relaxed, totally at ease. Just look at how I'm sitting. Well, I feel so nice. Now that's the pleasure of relaxation of the body. And it's amazed how many people don't know how to relax their own body, which is one of the reasons you get sick and die young. I'm over 60. The last time I went to see my doctor was about 20, 30 years ago, I think. I'm incredibly healthy. And the reason is I know how to relax. And it feels so happy to relax. Now you do that to your body, first of all. Now you do that to your mental world. Relax the mind. This beautiful kindness and mindfulness. Because it's being kind to your body to tell yourself to relax. It's being compassionate. You deserve it. And when your mind starts to relax, oh, that feels so wonderful. I haven't got this tightness of having to perform, having to reach some goal, having to push and pull. Have you got a boss at work who makes you work too hard? Have you got what we call the boss from hell? Many of you are nodding your head. You know what I mean. The boss at the office is nothing as bad as the boss between your ears. Always pushing you, criticizing you, making you work so hard, even when you get home and go to sleep at night, will never let you stop. Imagine that little control freak in your mental world. Imagine they get sick one day and disappear. And there's nothing to do, nothing to achieve, nowhere to go. You can relax and be at peace. Oh, what bliss. Now you have an idea what calming the mental world is like. Thought comes into mind, you can come if you like, you can stay. You can get tired, fall asleep, that's fine. No rules, no force, no one telling you what to do inside your own head. Freedom, peace at last. That's so nice. That's what I do most of my time.
Ajahn Brahm?
Yeah, go on.
When you lie on the beach and you are relaxed, unless you fall asleep, you tend to move your body or adjust your body, and then you start thinking about, oh, what I'm going to do next, what I'm going to eat.
Yeah.
Which is very different from being in a meditation retreat because, well, there's nothing else to do but meditate. And it's only when you're meditating that your body is really still.
It is, but that's where you learn how to be still and relax and let go, in a meditation retreat. But then you learn to do that when you get home. You're driving in the car to work and you get stuck in the traffic. Brilliant, I can just relax and just be in this moment. Just enjoy not having to drive the car and worry about anything. There are so many moments in your life which give you the opportunity not to do things. But instead, we look at our BlackBerry to see if there's any emails. Remember, if you make peace a priority, then it's very easy to meditate. If getting your emails done first is a priority, you will never have any time at all. There was an old story of a man who rang the monk at his temple and called him and said, "Venerable sir, I need you to come to my house to do some chanting today." And the monk replied, "I'm sorry, sir, I'm busy." And the man said, "What are you doing?" And the monk said, "I'm doing nothing." That's what a monk is supposed to do. And the layman understood he was a Buddhist, so he hung up the phone. And he rang the temple the following day, got the same monk and asked, "Venerable sir, I need a monk to do some chanting in my house." And the monk said, "I'm sorry, I'm busy." And he said, "What are you doing today?" And the monk said, "Same as yesterday, I'm doing nothing." "But that's what you said to me yesterday." "Exactly," said the monk, "I'm not finished yet." If you understand that story, you understand how to meditate. Please give doing nothing priority. Get that out of the way first. And then afterwards, once you've relaxed, then you can really perform. Get heaps of work done. High quality, no stress. But get nothing out of the way first. And then everything else falls into place.
For most people who are trying to meditate or who are meditating, find that the thoughts keep arising. And therefore, they don't have a lot of peace when they're meditating because things keep popping up. And you either go back to the past or into the future or a whole lot of conversations. So how do you deal with that?
Okay, this is the first example of meditation, which is what she was asking me to talk about. The first reason why we can't relax is because we worry so much about the past, are so anxious about the future. So it means you can't relax. So the simple technique is when you close your eyes. You can do this when you're going to bed tonight, if you like. Laying down, relaxed. Imagine you are carrying two heavy bags. Either you're going overseas, I travel a lot, I see people with these really heavy suitcases. Or you may be going shopping, you have these two heavy bags.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to stop there, please. Let's do it right now. How's that? Would you all like to do it right now?
Okay. I suppose we better. She's the president, so... Okay.
How many of you would like to do it right now?
Very good. Okay, here we go. Okay. That's enough. We're going to do it anyway. It doesn't matter how many people put up their hands. So, don't move as you're sitting now is good enough. Just close your eyes. Just relax the body. Now imagine you're carrying two really heavy shopping bags or suitcases. And you've been carrying them for a long time. You know what it feels like? Your arms ache and your shoulders hurt. Remember what the times when that's happened before? You know that ache in your shoulder, that pain in your arms, because you've been carrying these bags a long time. And you look at that imaginary bag in your left hand. On the outside, you can see the four letters P-A-S-T, because that bag contains all of your past. Not just what happened an hour ago, not just what happened today. All your memories, good and bad, over your whole life. That's the past which you've been carrying around too long. So just like a real shopping bag makes your arms ache, carrying around your past makes your heart, your mind ache. And then you look at in your imagination, you imagine the shopping bag or the suitcase in your right hand. That is also incredibly heavy. And you've been carrying it around so long that that hurts too. And you look on the outside of that bag and you see the letters F-U-T-U-R-E, future. That is all your hopes and dreams, your anxieties and fears, all stuffed into that bag called a future, which you've been carrying for far too long. Just imagine how heavy it is. And once you feel the pain, focus on the bag in your left hand, representing your past. And imagine your back leaning to the left as you lower that bag to the ground, but do it slowly. Imagine lowering the bag, the heavy weight of the past, onto the floor. And when it reaches the floor, all the weight disappears. There's no burden anymore. And you uncurl your fingers from the handle. Straighten up your spine so you can lift your left arm. so it can be hanging loosely by your side. Relaxed, recuperating, re-energizing. You've let go of your past. And then you imagine that suitcase in the right hand, the shopping bag, representing your future, your hopes, dreams, anxieties, fears and worries. And then you start lowering that to the ground. As your spine starts to lean to the right, as it gets closer and closer to the floor, and then that moment, that magic moment, when the burden is relieved, you move your hand away from the handle of the bag, straighten up your back so your right arm can rest, recuperate, re-energize. You've let go of your future. Send those two bags, the past and the future. And you imagine yourself looking down at those two heavy burdens. And you are standing in that wonderful, peaceful place, right between the past and the future, called the present moment. At peace, relaxed, and free. And you appreciate what it feels like. You're resting, you're relaxing. You deserve this. Soon, you'll have to open your eyes and pick up those bags again. But not yet. Enjoy the rest. Remind yourself, it's not just you deserve it, but afterwards you'll be able to carry those bags with no stress. Just like when I put down the orange juice and picked it up 30 seconds later, it was not painful anymore, because I could rest, therefore I could handle the burdens far, far easily. So you're just in this beautiful present moment. No past, no future. Just like when you were a child. In the moment, alert, no past, no future. That's how it works. Now you can open your eyes and pick up those stupid bags again. Okay. By the way, when I first did that, I was a student at Cambridge University. This is why it is academically a wonderful thing to teach your children. I was 1972 doing the final examinations in natural sciences, theoretical physics. In that time, everything depended upon those series of exams. You passed, you failed, and that was it. So, in natural sciences in 1972, theoretical physics, it started off on a Monday morning with a 3-hour paper from 9 till 12. We had 1 hour for lunch. 1 o'clock we had to be back again for the afternoon paper from 1 till 4. 3 hour in the morning, 3 hour in the afternoon, starting on Monday, the same on Tuesday, the same on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday as well, 6 days in a row, with no break. That was torture. If Amnesty International had known about that, they'd have put the Vice Chancellor in prison. But I had an advantage. Instead of going to the cafeteria to eat lunch, I never had lunch in those 6 days. Instead, I went to my room and meditated. When I sat on my cushion and closed my eyes, what do you think the first thing which came into my head was? Morning exam, yeah. The past. And of course, I started thinking, did I make that answer correct? Should I have added more explanation? You all know that you can't change the morning exam. It's finished, it's done. Good or bad, it's too late. But how many of you can let it go? Because I trained myself with the suitcase simile, I could let it go easy. Because it was really important, I rested. I had a big exam coming later. If I kept worrying about the past, I would be really hurting my future, as many of you do. So I let that go. The next thing which came into my head, afternoon exam. Let's get the books out, do some more study, just in case. One thing I noticed, if you study at the last minute, whatever you swat in the last half an hour before the exam never ever comes up. Never. Total waste of time. And anyway, I realized I had a big exam coming up in half an hour, I'd better relax. That was the best preparation. How many of you can let go of fear? That was scary. Final exams. But I could let go of that suitcase to the future, put it down. Because I realized the importance of just rest. And as soon as I put down that past and the future, the next thing I became aware of, and this was very important for you to understand, my body was shaking. I was nervous. I never ever thought of myself as a nervous person, but this was a high stress situation. I thought my life depended upon these examinations. If only I had known at the time I was going to become a monk, I would not have worried so much. We didn't know that at the time, so my body was shaking. But when you realize the physical problems, it's very easy to relax them, to let them go. A lot of people's health problems come because we're not aware of our body. The heart flutters, the lump in your breast, the problems in your brain. We're so busy with the past and future, we don't know what's really going on in our body. So we don't know how to relax and deal with it. As soon as I noticed, had mindfulness of the body, that I was shaking, it was very easy to relax. The body relaxed. And the last thing I noticed, only half an hour meditation, was another very important thing for you to know here in Singapore. How tired my brain was. It was exhausted. It had just done a 3-hour paper in very high mathematics. Very stressed. And I never realized how tired a brain could be. It's one of the reasons why people get grumpy, angry, and have many other emotional problems. Somebody asked me in Kuala Lumpur, I get angry, can you please give me a way to stop my anger? And I said, get more sleep. And that was a very profound answer. If you slept more and relaxed more, you wouldn't get so angry at others and they wouldn't get angry at you. You'd feel better, you'd be healthier, you'd be happier. So many emotional, physical problems come because of chronic tiredness. Many of you got used to it, you take it for granted, but you are exhausted sometimes. Actually, a lot of the time. You don't know how to relax and rest. So I saw my brain was really tired. The way I described it was like a used tea bag. Had no essence, no oomph in it anymore. And all I needed to do was to keep it still. And I saw all this energy coming back again. After half an hour, that's all it took, I was bright, relaxed, as if he'd just woken up in the morning after a really good night's sleep. And I went into those afternoon examinations. My friends told me this, only afterwards, because you know you don't talk to each other on these big exams because you're competing. You're competing with your friends. It's a terrible thing to do. But at the end they said, what the heck were you doing? Because you went into every afternoon exam smiling. Some of them thought I was cheating. I found out the papers and I was cheating. That's why they thought I was happy. And it wasn't. It was because I'd been meditating. That was why. And I did really well. And that was my examination technique. teach it to your kids or anyone else in university or at school, my goodness, it works. You clear the mind, energize it, and it's powerful. But letting go of the past and the future comes first. Yeah, you put your thing close to your mouth. Go on.
Ajahn Brahm, now that there are lots of places you can go and learn meditation, develop mindfulness, so what is uniquely different about Buddhist meditation then?
There's nothing really uniquely different, but except that, you know, we've got the full package. You know, look, we invented it 2,500 years ago, but, you know, like being Buddhist, being kind, we never got the patent. Anybody do it, and it's very good. But, you know, basically, you know, we are the experts. And if you go and see a doctor, you want to go and see the professor at the university, the ones who just really, it's their life's work. That's why, you know, the real great teachers are these monks and nuns, you know, who've been meditating for years and years, and you can actually see the result.
So, Ajahn Brahm, what are the lights that you see in your mind? I mean, you call them nimitta, but where do they come from?
Okay, you're getting to deep meditation now, but I'm going to stop you and go back a bit. Because it's not just being in the present moment, it's also learning how to be silent, stopping those thoughts. And a lot of times people have told me they can't stop thinking. I did this at Kong Meng Sun one lunchtime when we had a meditation session for executives just for 1 hour. People who just came, you know, extended their lunch hour to come. And I wanted to teach them very quickly how to stop thinking. And I'm going to do the same exercise with you right now. I've already taught you how to be in the present moment. This is how to be still inside. Because as I'm speaking to you, I want you also to notice your reaction inside your own mind as I'm speaking. Because as I'm talking to you, you will begin to notice that there are some spaces between my words. In those pauses, what was going on in your mind? You were silent. You were aware with no thought going on. That there is again the silent mind. Doesn't that feel amazing? Wow. I can meditate after all. In meditation we extend those spaces, minutes, even hours if you're a professional meditator. Imagine what that feels like. Bliss, peace, wow. That's where you start to really get into meditation, in the silence of your mind. Yeah, go on. It's a great simile. It gives people a taste of what we're talking about. So what happens next? You get so silent, so still. There's something in my book, The Art of Disappearing. You made the connection between stillness and disappearing. When I was young, going to all these other different types of meditation, I went to a Zen retreat once. And at that Zen retreat, we were told to face the wall with our eyes open. Really weird. I didn't know what I was supposed to be doing. But as I was watching this white wall in this little temple run by Westerners in Northumberland, outside of Newcastle, in England, I was watching this wall, maybe after 10 or 15 minutes, being quite peaceful, and then the wall disappeared. It vanished. That was really weird. You've done your science. This is just the nature of the brain. It's only wired to notice things which change. The hum of the aircon in this room, after a while you just don't hear it. The feeling in your body, you just don't feel it after a while. If it doesn't, you know, ache or it doesn't have a great pain, it just disappears. And even if you just watch a wall, after a while, it vanishes. In fact, if you want to try this, just close your eyes. When you first close your eyes, you can see the back of your eyelids. After a few seconds, because that doesn't interest the brain, the sense of sight turns off. You're not seeing anything. Through stillness, those parts of the brain which deal with that particular sense turn off. And that is what meditation, the deep meditation, starts to do. Because you're sitting still with your eyes closed in a peaceful place, after a while you don't see, you don't hear anything, you don't smell, taste, and the best thing is your body vanishes. You can't feel your nose, you can't feel your legs, your hands go, bye-bye. You know that is so much bliss. I don't know about your body, but my body is always itching and aching. It never gives me a moment's rest. It's a pain in the ass, basically. And I know that because when it disappears, you feel so free. And that's what happens, Angie, when it disappears. The sixth sense, which is not a movie, it's your mind. That's what manifests when the five senses vanish. You see this beautiful light in the mind, which is just the way you perceive this thing called the sixth sense of the mind. Even in European psychology and philosophy, the Greeks, read your Aristotle, started with six senses. The five senses plus the mind as number six. Somewhere in 2,200 years of Western culture, we lost our mind. We've only got five senses left now. That's one of the reasons the West is really screwed up. There was always there, and this is what you come across when you get into that state of meditation. You see a beautiful light in the mind. By that time you'd be very peaceful and very happy. Nothing to be afraid of. This is what deep meditation is supposed to do for you. Relaxing your body. And if you do get into those states, when you come back to your body, this is the weird stuff. This is going much deeper than just relaxation. You find many of these diseases, these problems in your body, vanish. It's incredibly therapeutic. I told somebody just last night in Kuala Lumpur, an example of one person amongst many, Angie, I've met. I've been doing this for a long time now. I was teaching a meditation retreat in Sydney, teaching exactly the same things I teach you, taught Angie, and the retreats, which I will teach at Phuket. And this man in the retreat, he was meditating, making a really loud noise. And coughing as well. He was breathing through his mouth. And people complained. Can't you tell people to breathe quietly? And then I announced that that man had a big tumor in his nose. He had nasal cancer. His doctors had given up hope. It was terminal. No more treatment. He'd been there and done that. Nothing was working. He'd come to do some meditation as the last throw of the dice. And throughout the whole retreat, he was making this noise. And when the 9 days had ended, he came to see me. He wanted to have a quick interview before I left. She said, the last hour or two, while he was meditating, he heard a pop. I remember that's how he said, he heard a pop in his head, and the air could go in his nose again. The tumor had opened up, only for 1 or 2 minutes, then it closed again, and he had to breathe through his mouth again. But it was a miracle. No, for months he'd never been able to do that. Now he could breathe through his nose for 1 minute. When he told me that, I encouraged him, but I thought he'd left it far too late. He was going to die. And I gave him up for dead. And about 3 or 4 years later, when I was teaching a small meditation group in Crow's Nest, that's just north of Sydney, this guy came up to me and said, do you remember me? And I said, I looked at him, I said, I don't remember you. Have I met you before? He said, I was that guy. I carried on. The tumor completely disappeared. And I'm spending the rest of my life teaching other people how to meditate. That's one story amongst many. You know, it's anecdotal, but it is true. I'm an honest monk. I don't exaggerate. So there are some amazing things happen. And now I know why it happens. Now your body has got some incredible mechanisms for healing itself. The problem is you get in the way. Your worry, your fear, your controlling, you stop things healing themselves. You are the problem. So when you meditate, you get out of the way. You let go, you relax. You stop controlling. You're so at peace, everything relaxes. Give healing a chance. Worry, fear kills more people than diseases do.
Well, it goes to show that we have our miracles, it's just that we don't boast about them.
Oh yeah, and there's heaps of them there. Sometimes it is inspiring when that happens. There was another guy, I think he actually came from Singapore. He came to one of my retreats in Perth. He checked in first of all because he said, I'm not sure if I can last a couple of hours. He wasn't sure he could last a couple of hours. And the reason was, he was wearing a rubber face mask. I'm done, okay. He was wearing a rubber face mask because he had this terrible case of eczema. Psoriasis over the whole of his body. You know, he lifted up his shirt to show me. It was covered from head to toe, all over with this rash. He had to wear this face mask to stop him scratching himself. And he said, this is every second is torture. And when I saw what he was going through, I thought, that is just so terrible. You know, even in Guantanamo Bay, you know, the guards stop torturing you, they give you a rest. But this was 24 hours a day. If you've ever had a bad rash on you, which is really itchy, I mean really itchy, imagine having one over your whole body, every square centimeter of your skin with this terrible rash. And I felt so much compassion for that guy. And he lasted. He did the whole 9 days of meditation. And I thought he was a hero until he came to report to me at the end. He lifted up, his trouser legs, opened up his shirt, his mask was off. It totally cleared up except for a small band maybe an inch wide around both his ankles. And my goodness, did he look happy. He said, this is nothing, this is nothing at all. I can handle this, no problem at all, but look at me. It's all gone. Thank you so much. And I get so much joy out of that. You took a guy who was tortured and freed him simply because you learned how to meditate properly, and it, my goodness, it works. There's many miracles like that. And it's not just, people say they feel better. You see it on his body. The before and after. And it's not imagination. You can see all those rashes totally disappeared and had normal skin again. That's what's really impressive. Yeah, it certainly does work. But you've got to do it properly. Don't mess around.
Ajahn Brahm, so when you go in and when you meditate and say you can meditate up to an hour and then you come out of meditation and the happiness is gone, right? Because all your thoughts might come right back in and you're back to where you were. So how do you therefore guide someone to keep them happiness going?
You don't need to guide them. You've relaxed. You've rested. You got this huge boost of energy. Look, that's what runs me. And I don't just run on orange juice or coffee. I run on vitamin M, meditation. That's what keeps me going. Remember, Angie, when we had those concerts? We had these concerts, I forget what they were, Passage of Time or whatever. I remember once you said, Ajahn Brahm, you have to get here in time because we're doing an afternoon matinee on Saturday. So I managed to get to the airport on the, you know, the morning flight from Perth, straight from there to the theatre, straight into action. And after you'd finished, you guys all went out for dinner. I didn't have it in there. I was wiped out. I'm really tired, and I was worried that how on earth am I going to perform in the afternoon, in the evening? All these people were coming to see us. They'd paid money, and I was just exhausted. The night before, I'd been up late giving a big talk in Perth, doing all the other stuff which I had to do. I was totally exhausted. So I didn't go for dinner. At that theatre, that was a Victoria Theatre, wasn't it?
Jubilee Hall?
Jubilee Hall, okay. There was one exit which was blocked and locked. So I had a little quiet place I could sit meditation. Only half an hour, that's all it took. When I came out afterwards, I was buzzing. I had so much energy. Anyone who saw me would probably think I was on ice, taking some methamphetamine. They would. Because I had an incredible boost of power. And I don't mind saying these things. I did that a couple of days ago. I had this executive retreat for all these big shots and CEOs. They paid 1,500 ringgit each for the day with me. All that is a donation to a monastery over in Perth. Now, if you don't charge CEOs, they don't come. It's just, you know, their nature. So I taught them this, and you know, they really wanted value for their money, so I really gave them hard talks.
So how many CEOs were there?
22 CEOs. So just after the morning session, I had a break for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then I had to do interviews. It's only supposed to be 10 or 15 minutes each. And of course, they all wanted 20 minutes, 25 minutes. So before then, I knew I really had to get my act together. Meditating, first of all feeling this terrible tiredness and sleepiness, and then getting so still you can feel the back straighten up, the energy come in, the power return to your mind. And it was an incredible big boost, like a billion watts going through your brain. And then talking to all these people without stop for 5 hours, not going to the toilet, next please, 5 hours, paying 100% full attention to everyone. And that was really impressive. And after 5 hours, give me more, give me more. And that is what happens. You get into meditation, you get peaceful, you get power, you get happy. It doesn't stop. It lasts for a long period of time afterwards. You're energized, you're happy, you're powerful. And that's how you feel that power. That is what runs me.
Ajahn Brahm, in Buddhism, it's not just meditation, right? Because in the West, some people do meditation, but they don't study the Dhamma. And there's a difference. They don't believe in rebirth. They don't feel they need to observe the precepts and follow the Noble Eightfold Path. So what kind of meditator do they become?
Just like me. when I was young. You know, like many people today, you know, we won't do things out of belief. Prove it. Why should you keep these precepts? Now, having a drink is fun. I'm not going to get drunk, just have a bit of wine, that's all. I'm just going to just, you know, enjoy myself. You know, if you find a nice girl, have sex with her. You know, she's consenting. What's the big deal? I never understood precepts and virtue until I started meditating. Because it not only energizes you, it gives you incredible clarity. In other words, you see more deeply into things when the mind is bright. You've got more power. And that's why I started meditating first. And then I thought, and this is very clear, why on earth do I take alcohol? Basically, the feeling was it didn't make any sense at all. It was just obvious. Why just, you know, you find a nice girl and exploit her body for sex and exploit your own body for that just, you know, pleasure. If there was, you know, some love there, some emotional attachment, yeah, fine. You know, that was an expression, you know, of this great thing we call love and intimacy. There's something more than just pleasure. And you could see that. You just naturally became more virtuous. And you naturally became more compassionate. It was just part of what happens when you see, you know, what goes on inside of you. Which is one of the reasons why people who start meditating first, they meditate first, they get wise, they get powerful, and then all the virtue becomes natural. They're not just goody-goodies, you know, keeping their precepts because they're president of the Buddhist Fellowship. I better keep them, otherwise I'll be in trouble. You just can't not keep them. And that's one of the problems. You know, even some monks, sometimes I feel, I understand where they're coming from. Their meditation isn't deep. Their urges are to break precepts. So it's very tough for them to stop themselves. But you know, once they get, you know, deep wisdom and understanding, it becomes natural to be kind, to be good, to be caring. That's one of the amazing things of things like meditation. You do become far more sensitive to each other. This is one of my students a long time ago. She was a primary school teacher teaching grade 6. And because she was, you know, interested in meditation, I think she had some panic disorders, and she treated her panic disorders through meditation. She started teaching her kids in school meditation. She called it quiet time, so, you know, people of other religions would not be worried about it. And she started in the year just 2 or 3 minutes of quiet time, teaching the kids how to meditate, building up to 15 minutes later on in the school year. Not only did it increase the academic performance, I went to see the principal once. He said, look, I'm a devout Christian. I will never change being a Christian, but this works. I've seen it. I know it. It works. That's why I keep encouraging it. But she said some of the unexpected consequences were these, you know, group of, you know, 10, 11-year-olds. Even the boys started getting very sensitive and caring to each other. They'd notice a child who came to school upset and spent time with them. It was literally opening up their compassion. So she said this was wonderful to see, unexpected, but the kindness and the goodness came naturally as a result. So it's no longer being a goody-goody because you want to go to heaven, or because, you know, you want to make good karma, or you're afraid of other people criticizing you. It becomes this natural outflowing of the heart. That's so wonderful to see. So your virtue becomes natural rather than forced. You know what it's like? You know, some of you, Waysack Day coming soon, if you put it, I've got to keep the 5 precepts, I've got to be vegetarian for the day, I've got to do this, and oh God, here we go again. But, you know, if you're really getting the meditation, you just, I want to do it. And you're really natural, you can't stop yourself doing it.
So Ajahn Brahm, how does meditation really take us to the final enlightenment, which is supposed to be our aim as a Buddhist?
Okay, now you're getting into the deeper types of meditation, really deep. When you see things disappear, then you know what they are. There's a simile which I developed, because yeah, you got old similes over in the time of the Buddha, but a lot of those similes, you know, they were from that time, a lot of military similes, generals or farming similes, but why don't we make new ones? And so I've been very up there, out there, making new similes to actually explain these things. And the best simile I've come up with to answer your question, Angie, is a simile of the tadpole and the frog. Once a tadpole was born in a lake, grew up in the lake, spent all its time in the water, and one day someone came along and said about water. The tadpole had no idea of what the person was talking about. Even though the tadpole went to lectures about water, still couldn't really understand what water was. And one day the tadpole went to Abhidharma class about water, still couldn't understand. Just theory. But one day that tadpole grew into a frog. It developed legs, and one day little tadpole, she jumped outside of the lake for the very first time in her life and noticed something was very different. Something which had always been there had now vanished. Now she can understand what water is, that strange stuff which is no longer there. Now, how do you understand what your body is when it's always there? One day, you'll meditate and your body will totally disappear, leaving only your mind. What was this amazing experience? Something is missing. Your body. Now you know what this body is. If you think you understand the body in which you're sitting right now, it is a myth. You don't understand. You were born in the body, spent all your time in this body. How on earth can you know what this body is? You think you do, you don't. So then you understand this body and its five senses is gone. Now you've got some insight and wisdom. As you go deeper in this meditation, you become so still, not even your mind moves. And you notice something else has disappeared. Something which has always been there for the time you can remember has suddenly gone. And that is really weird. What has disappeared is your will. Your choice, the thing which makes all the decisions, the thing which controls your life. That is freaky. One of the weirdest things which happens in meditation. But just like the tadpole, now a frog, now you know what this will truly is. This thing which has disappeared. This thing which you have cherished as being one of your most important possessions. I'm really going into the deep stuff now, but many of you come to this place, the Buddhist Fellowship, thinking if you can become smarter and wiser, in other words, teach your will to make good decisions rather than stupid decisions, you'll have less problems in your life. You just come here to train your will to be wise and compassionate. But now you realize it wasn't your will anyway. That is spooky. And you can't accept that. None of you here, if you are honest, can understand what I'm talking about. The reason is because you've been born in your will, spent all your time in your will. It's always been there for you. Sometimes you've not exercised it, but it's always been there. And one day, you little tadpoles will become frogs. You go into such a deep meditation, the will has gone and disappeared. Now you understand what it is. That is the sort of insights where you get enlightened. You see a different truth, just like the tadpole now understands water, because it's now a frog. You ask that question, and sometimes, I write all these books about two bad bricks in a wall opening the door of your heart, but it doesn't stop there. This teaching goes really deep. And you find out, wow, this is what enlightenment is all about. You don't need to be scared. Because it's a huge relief to feel that my will has nothing to do with me. So I'm not responsible for all those bad jokes which I've said over the years. It wasn't me, I had no choice. Just like I had no choice about telling you my latest joke, which I got from Kuala Lumpur. The shortest fairy tale goes like this. Once upon a time, a boy proposed to a girl. She said no, and they both lived happily ever after.
You're divorced.
That's a good one.
The shortest fairy tale has to begin once upon a time, and it has to end with they both live happily ever after.
Well,
and please don't blame me, those of you getting married tomorrow. I've got no choice. I had to tell you that.
And he's warned you.
No, sometimes marriages are wonderful.
Well, so...
Wow!
Okay,
you
okay.
Cynics.
Yeah,
go
take
on.
A drink. I'll ask you a question.
Go on.
Ajahn Brahm, I remember you once said that if you've never experienced this art of this disappearing act,
yeah,
you will one day, which is when you die. Because
oh, that's
when
interesting
you have to
thing.
Give up your body, right? And your will.
Yeah. Because that's one of the things in this meditation which we teach, and people experience this. Did you experience those lights in meditation?
I'm not supposed to say.
Yeah, you can.
Okay.
That's okay. But yeah, a lot of people do. The body disappears and they see these beautiful lights in their mind. And it really sort of is weird because the body's gone. It's incredibly beautiful lights in the mind. And there's something which should click inside of them, because there's another time people see that beautiful light, which everybody sees that light. You've all read or seen on the movies or the TV, read books, NDEs, near-death experiences. There are stories of people who have cardiac arrest and say they floated out of their body, they could remember what was going on, somehow or other they come back to life again and they tell this story. Now this is not a myth. Many, many people from different religions and different cultures experience that and say about that. There may be some people here who've had those near-death experiences, and as many people tell stories about them. And there's people like Professor Pim van Lommel who do hard scientific research on them. Peter Fenwick, Southampton University, and there's somebody else whose name I keep forgetting, but he also does research to make sure these are authentic experiences, that what these people see and hear actually happened. They're not making it up. And also there's no way they could have known these things. One of the classical stories, which now talking again about this a couple of days ago, on one operating theater, somebody died, floated up above the operating theater, and this was an old sort of hospital, And so in the operating theatre, there was no windows except very high up, you know, to give some sort of ventilation or some light. And they saw on the ledge, there was a tennis shoe on the ledge by the window, which could not be seen from down below. So when they came back, they said what had happened to them and said, oh, by the way, there's a tennis shoe up there. And they said, there can't be a tennis. This is an operating theatre. We have to have hygiene. It's cleaned. And you can't see it from down below. But one of the doctors or nurses, I don't know what, was intrigued enough to get a ladder out. They climbed the ladder. There's a tennis shoe up there. And that was just one case. You know, things which you would not expect, which no one believed was there, but which were there, because the patient floated up and saw it. But the other part of the experience, yeah, you leave your body, see what's going on, and then you go towards the light. You heard that before? That is exactly the same light you see in this part of meditation. Five senses vanished in meditation. In death or near death, your five senses turn off. That's what Professor Van Lommel found out. He wrote this up in Lancet about 10 years ago, in I think December or January 2001. I got a copy of the article back in Australia. He said what he found out, that these NDEs only happen when the brain stops functioning. It's not just cardiac arrest, but the brain has stopped functioning. And most of that article was arguing this cannot be an experience generated by the brain. It is when the brain is not working at all. That's the only time it happens. This is what is occurring. Can I tell the story of one of my disciples? This is sometimes people get scared. But
no, can you tell the story about Ajahn Chah? Because you mentioned his heart even stopped, but he wasn't dead.
Yeah, but that was only just the heart stopping. This is the brain stopping, that's more important. Well, but Ajahn Chah. Well, this is a bit. Ajahn Chah's story first. And I have a friend, Greg, he comes number two. Now, my teacher, Ajahn Chah, he had a stroke. You know, it was excess water on the brain, whatever that's called, but that caused part of the brain to have trauma. And so he was paralyzed, could not speak for about 8 or 9 years of his life. But, first of all, I don't know if you know this, all the monks, his disciples, they met together, what should we do? And they said, just let nature take its course, let him die, you know, he's done enough. But the king of Thailand heard of that decision and countermanded it. No, keep Ajahn Chah alive. Now in Thailand, if the king tells the monks to do something, they've got no choice, they have to follow the king. That's the big shot in Thailand. So, the king was paying for a male nurse around the clock, you know, to look after Ajahn Chah's medical needs. And two or three monks would also stay with him to look after his other needs, washing his robes or whatever, helping feed him. So one of these nights, a couple of monks who I know personally were looking after him with the male nurse when Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. The male nurse started to freak out. The male nurse knew that one day Ajahn Chah would die. He just did not want Ajahn Chah to die on his shift. So he wanted to intervene. And the other monks who'd been there much longer said, oh, leave him alone, he's only going into deep meditation. And the doctor said, no, 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 he's dying. He said, no, he's done this before, leave him alone. And they had an argument, they came to a compromise. The nurse took blood samples every few minutes while Ajahn Chah wasn't breathing. No discernible pulse. And notice a weird thing, during the time that Ajahn Chah was not breathing for a couple of hours, the oxygen level in the blood was constant. That reassured the nurse, because as long as there's oxygen in the blood, there'll be no brain damage. And so as long as I didn't know where the oxygen was coming from, but it was there. So that satisfied the doctor, or the male nurse, that Ajahn Chah wasn't dying. And of course, Ajahn Chah never died. He died much later. But an even better example was one of my lay disciples. Sometimes people say, don't tell this story because it scares people. You don't have to be scared. There's no danger at all. Because this guy, he was meditating at home. He'd only meditate about half an hour. He wasn't a great meditator, but one day he really did it deeply. He told his wife one Sunday afternoon, I'm going in my bedroom to meditate. He never came out for an hour and a bit. So his wife went into the bedroom to check him out. And there he was, sitting perfectly still, still meditating. Too still. She couldn't see his chest come up and down. She went even closer and could see no breathing. So she immediately called for the ambulance. I don't know what it is in Singapore. It's 000 in Australia. What's it here? 991? 995. He called 995. My husband is dead. His cardiac arrest. Come quick. And responses are in 5 minutes or even less. This ambulance roared up into their driveway of their home. The medics, trained personnel, jumped out with all their equipment, took his pulse, no discernible pulse. He looked like he was under cardiac arrest, so they threw him into the gurney, into the back of the ambulance, top speed going through all the red lights, emergency, to get to the hospital as soon as possible. You know, you've seen this on sort of the movies. As soon as they get into the hospital, straight into the emergency room, strapping all this stuff all over him. First thing, the ECG. Flat line. Ding, 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 emergency. I was told it doesn't go ding, 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 but it's a wonderful part of the story. It gives it a bit more life. But he flat lined. And then they put the EEG on, another flat line. This was a great part of the story because they had all the medical equipment there. He was brain dead. No discernible mental activity at all, nor any activity of his heart. And he was very fortunate. I said, not so much him, but the people working in the morgue. He wasn't dead, he was just meditating. And if they'd have sent him to the morgue, which they usually do, he'd have probably killed the attendants when he came out of meditation and woke up. But the reason he was lucky is because the doctor on duty that Sunday afternoon was a young Indian-born doctor. And the Indian-born doctor had heard from his parents that sometimes yogis in deep meditation can suspend their life activity. He knew from the wife who was accompanying him that, you know, he'd been meditating. So he decided not to give up on him yet. So instead they put these defibrillators on his chest. Again, you may have seen them in the movies. It's electric shocks which make you rise up above the gurney. Many, many, many times I did this. Still no beeps on the ECG or EEG, still flatlining for, I don't know, half an hour, 45 minutes. Usually you should be dead. But he kept on going. And then, not from the electric shock, but this disciple just decided, time to come out of meditation. That's all. Opened his eyes, beep, beep, beep. The doctor was stunned. The wife was so relieved, he was just blissed out, and the doctor gave him a thorough examination and said, I can't find anything wrong with you. He walked home with his wife. Dude wasn't admitted at all, just walked home. It's a wonderful story. He said it was just so much ecstasy and bliss, being so peaceful. Never felt any of those defibrillators, never heard na da 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 of the ambulance. And he said the only unpleasant part of it was the scolding he got from his wife on the way home. She really gave it to him. Don't you ever do that to me again. I thought you were dead. Now, that's a true story. Now, he happened to get into some deep meditation. But interesting, Angie, and for everybody else, when he told me that story, you know, I knew exactly what he was doing and where he got to. I asked him, how come this time that happened to you? You know what he said? He said, for the first time, I really let go. I really let go. I mention that to people because that is the trick. Pressing the letting go button. Everything gets so peaceful and still. Have such a happy time. Get so much understanding about the nature of this body and this mind. Look, I'm a scientist. And basically, I don't mind using sort of, you know, coarse language. It really pisses me off when scientists continue to say the mind is some byproduct of the brain. They simply do not know what they're talking about. The evidence is there, it's strong. The mind is something totally different. I know that because I've been there so many times. You understand the mind from experience. A mind which is there when the brain is not working at all. And so scientists, sometimes they've got so much dogmatism. One of the reasons why scientists are losing their reputation, because they're not being scientific. They're not willing to throw away their cherished theories in the face of the facts. I don't know how people teach science in universities these days. I think they teach them belief rather than investigation. One of the reasons why science, especially in the West, is having this big problem with religion, science and religion, religion and science. And science is not doing its cause very well when it is so dogmatic.
Well, the good thing is Einstein did say that if there was a religion that would survive, science would be Buddhism.
But that was such a long time ago. That's past its use-by date.
Well, there's scientists and there's scientists.
Yeah, go on.
Okay, so Ajahn Brahm, last question, because it's another round tomorrow, and I know there's a question here, but it's going to be more related tomorrow. So the last question I have for you is about rebirth. How do you really find out about rebirth through meditation? Although you've mentioned it, but really, how do you find out?
Okay, Angie's asking all the interesting questions here. Now, usually, I don't like telling people these things because, you know, I don't like going too deep. But you ask the question, this is how it happens. When you get a powerful mind, and this is what happens when you meditate, your mind gets incredibly powerful. You feel that, you've got energy, you've got power. The mind is still, but it's really strong. It's a difference like between, you know, the lights in this room right now. And when you get into some powerful meditations, like this, the room is lit up. Megawatt lights. You can see a lot and it's really strong. When your mind is that powerful, it can do things. There is such things as reading minds. You don't like doing that because it is intrusive of your privacy. So good monks and good nuns, they may be able to do it, but they won't. Because that will scare the hell out of you, and it's a wrong thing to do. If good monks do it, they do it by accident. They just, in other words, they read the mind and thought, gee, I should have stopped myself. But also, such a powerful mind can do things like get memories from the past. There is one of the rules for being a monk. It's the eighth rule in the Paccitya section. We are not allowed to tell of our powers. I sometimes push that rule to the limit because I want to tell you what's true. So I found this loophole which will answer your question. I am not permitted to tell you details of my previous lives. So I can tell you details of how to remember your early life, because that's my first way I started developing these things. Years and years ago, meditating, I had a powerful meditation. You could feel the energy, the power. The mind was able to do things. You knew that. So I asked myself, what is my earliest memory? Just ask that, just one little question, hardly disturbing the peace at all. And then the mind was silent. And strangely, what happened? I can tell this personal experience because it's not really a past life, it's a loophole. So straight away, a smell came into my nose. And I recognized that smell immediately as the smell of my baby's pram. This little sort of, you know, thing on wheels, a baby was sitting and the mother would push it backwards and forwards. I think, is they call it a stroller? Or what? Pram, anyway, you know what I'm talking about. Sometimes these things change their names over 50, 60 years.
Still a pram,
okay. So it's my baby's pram. I recognized that was the smell of my pram. And straight away, with that recognition, this was in, no, maybe 1 or 2 seconds, I was back in my pram, re-experiencing what it was like to be a 2 or 3 week old baby. With the full ability to ask questions, move around, look around, and investigate. Strange experience. You weren't remembering it like you remember what you did this morning. It's like you're back in the morning, re-experiencing what was happening. And I investigated my pram, and then I saw my favorite toy when I was a kid. Not a kid. It was a little light blue toy in the shape of a pig, which my mother called Porky. Very original, but that's what she called it. It must have been some beans or some stuff inside because it would rattle. And my mother would walk it on its 2 legs. And I'd love that. It'd make me laugh every time. And there was me in my pram with my little favorite toy, Porky the pig, as maybe 2 or 3 weeks old infant. Now that shocked me. When he came out afterwards, I told a few people, people I could confide in, and one of them was a doctor. And that doctor told me, he said, that is very interesting because, as far as he knew, in the development of the brain of an infant, especially the sensory part of the brain, the dominant sense of a young infant is a sense of smell. That develops first. And I know what that doctor is talking about, because that experience was so strong I can remember it now. That is how infants recognize things. Yeah, they can see, but visual is not the dominant one. Sound is hardly there at all. But smell is so strong, you recognize your pram, you recognize your toy by its smell. Strange, but it's weird because you re-experience it. You know how true that is. And because I have a stupid sense of humor, I tell young mothers, please, when you have a young kid, never ever change your perfume because it will confuse the hell out of your kid. They won't know who you are. You'd be like having a face transplant for a kid. They won't recognize you. So that's what I can talk about. It's not past lives. But then you ask earlier, please. The mind is like a well-trained dog. Go and get the newspaper, go and get my slippers. It just does it happily. And now I have to generalize rather than being personal, otherwise I get into trouble with my rules. The next thing you remember, usually, it's amazing how I teach this to other people, they do it. Is the memory of your time in your mother's womb, floating in this liquid. I can describe that to you with words, but it does nothing to describe the real experience. You're there again. So never ever think that this being in your womb when you're pregnant is not feeling things, doesn't know things. It does. Because you can go back there. Earlier, please. And that's when the interesting stuff starts to happen. You're in the body of another person a long time ago. Now I'll give a warning for you, because often when I've taught this, it can only work when you've got good meditation. Sometimes what happens is that the memory you get first of all is the closest memory to this life, the strongest and most powerful memory, which is often your death in your past life. And remember, these aren't ordinary memories, these are re-experiencing it. And a couple of my meditators have got their past life when they were dying. And they say they never want to do this exercise ever again. It was painful, as many deaths are. Now you're re-experiencing that. And it's not pleasant. And many people, right, that's it, out of here. And I don't want to do this ever again. But please, you're missing a wonderful opportunity to discover about past lives, to prove it for yourself, so you have no more doubts anymore. So all you do, if you do this exercise and it starts to work, please, if you get an unpleasant experience, which is often your previous death, immediately say, earlier please. So you can just flip past that painful stuff and go to another memory of your past life. Just quickly say earlier, please. And then you won't have the trauma and the pain re-experienced again. You go back to something earlier in your past life. And then you can sort of also, you're there, and you can ask, who am I? What's my name? Where is this? Just those little thought questions gives you the answers straight away. You know who you are, where you are. Sometimes the time is difficult, because, you know, sometimes people don't pay as much importance to the month and the year as we do today. But you're there. You know who you are, where you are. And from that, when you come out of the meditation afterwards, the other amazing part of this, again, I can't really sort of describe it with too great detail, is the sense of certainty. You know that was you. You know it's not an imagination, it's not a myth. The same sense of certainty that you know you're hearing this right now. That's not a myth, you're not asleep, you're not imagining this talk. This is real. And that sense of reality was something unexpected and was something which was really interested me. Why are these experiences always carry around this sense of this is real, this is true? It's not imaginary, it's not a dream. You know, dreams, you know, you're not quite sure whether this is real or not. Sometimes in your dreams you think it's real, wake up, oh phew, that's great. Now I'm not falling off a cliff. But this is always carries with it this sense of this is true, this is real, this is not an imagination. I can't describe it more than that.
Well, thank you, Ajahn Brahm. So now you've got homework to do.
Yeah, and, but remember how to do it, guys. Please do it with kindness and with gentleness. And if you want to get these things, no way will you ever get them. You have to be peaceful. Let go, remember. Don't try. Don't want to be peaceful. That really screws the mind up. Stop wanting. Stop moving backwards and forwards in time. Wanting this, being afraid of that. See if you can let the mind be still. Put the glass down and it becomes still all by itself. And these things just happen. You don't want them to happen, you don't make them happen. They just come to you. So I had to say that because that's important.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Well, for those of you who've got the good karma to come to Kalat for the meditation retreat, it's from the 9th, I believe, to the 17th. And otherwise, you can come to the weekend retreat that Ajahn Brahmali, who is Ajahn Brahm's disciple, his right-hand man from Bodhiana Monastery, will be conducting a weekend, like a four-day retreat in July. And in October, towards the end, there'll be a eight-day meditation retreat in Perth, Ajana Grove, just before Katina. It's advisable for you to do a short retreat before you attempt a long one, because that just helps you to build more confidence and to have a better preparation before you go for a long retreat. So with that, I think we will end the evening tonight. Tomorrow there's going to be a session on how to apply wisdom to solving problems, or in short, called the magic of wisdom. So do come back for tomorrow night, and if you haven't got tickets yet, have faith in your good karma. Just come along, and hopefully some people won't show up, and you get in anyway. And as I mentioned earlier on, there are other talks coming up by Venerable Hasapana, the abbot from Dhammasara Monastery, and also the Vesak Carnival to celebrate Vesak. So don't miss that. Please come and have a good time on Vesak with us. And certainly all the other activities that we'll be holding at Buddhist Fellowship, you're most welcome. So before we end, we'd like to ask Ajahn Brahm to give us some blessings, and you can put your hands together to receive the blessings.
And also remember, when you do get powerful meditation, your mind has such power, the blessings work. If you listen to them on tape or on the computer's got no power, it's just words. These blessings are from a real person. These have the power. Sabaroga Winimuto Sabha Santa Pavachito Sabha Vera Mati Gando Nibuto Chatu Wang Bawa Sabitio Iwa Chantu Sabarogo Inasatu Mate Bhavan Vantarayo Sukhi Digayu Gopava Apiwa Dhanasilitsa Nichang Vuta Pachalino Chataro Dhamma Vatanti Ayu Vano Sukhang Bala.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you. On behalf of everyone here in the Buddhist Fellowship, thank you very much, Ajahn Brahm. And also I'd like to thank the staff of the Buddhist Fellowship and all the volunteers. Please give them a round of applause as well. So do remember to pick up a DVD on the Forest Way, and also the book Out of Disappearing is out there, or The Happiness to Meditation. The donations, are, if you're giving any, will be going to the Dhammasara Nuns Monastery. Thank you and good night. See you tomorrow, and wishing you a very happy Vesak.